place didn't use hawks and falcons for sport. Putting the kennel close to the living area was odd, too. Normally, there would be things like storage buildings, a dairy, or a wash house here. Then again, normally there'd be gardens back here, and there wasn't a sign that there had ever been anything growing inside this fence but grass. The more he looked at this place, the odder it got. Well, maybe the dairy and the wash house were in the big building itself, and not everyone knew you could tame hawks. Or maybe there was an even simpler reason why there was no mews. Maybe the people who had built this place knew all about the Taledras and wanted nothing to do with them, and correctly assumed allowing any birds of prey onto the property was allowing a potential spy in their midst. Well, just at the moment, he couldn't exactly snoop around inside the big house, and it wasn't exactly urgent to find out where the ruddy dairy was. So the nearest building was the kennel and yard. The grass in the yard had been pretty thoroughly killed by all the dog urine, so it was bare earth now. Right after the kennel was the stable, or rather, stables. There was more than one stable, but it looked as if these mercenaries didn't have many horses, so they were only using one for its original purpose. Empty wagons were parked against the walls. The other three stable buildings had been set up as barracks. He'd seen that when Laurel went exploring, which means there are no actual barracks buildings for guards or soldiers in here either. That's very odd. Where did they put their guards? Or did they rely entirely on dogs as guards? If there had been a force of human guards outside the fence, and dogs and handlers only inside, he supposed that would work. Maybe that was the reason why the kennels were so big and positioned right next to the big house. The two stable-slash-barracks buildings on his left were empty, according to Laurel, but they peeked in and saw cots and belongings in the stalls. But the two on the right?
Careful,
Laurel said, as they eased themselves inside. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust, but he could already tell just by listening to the snoring that this was where the mercenaries on night guard were sleeping. Curiously, it was much cooler inside this building than it was outside. In fact, it was almost as cool as if the wood it was made of had the same insulating properties as thick stone. He hadn't noticed that about the kennel because he'd been keeping all the windows and the door in the yard wide open to encourage a breeze to come through. He pulled his attention back to the here and now, because he'd based his estimates of the number of mercenaries here on the ones he and Laurel had seen outside, and here were two whole buildings full of men he hadn't counted. How did you miss these men? He asked Laurel incredulously.
Why are they sleeping in the daytime?
He asked back, just as incredulously. They looked at each other.
We both should be more mindful that you are a human and I am a Kairi,
Laurel said after a moment. After a quick survey of the two tenanted stable buildings, it became obvious that there were at least twice as many mercenaries here as he had thought. Which begged the question, how many more had they missed on their first estimation? How many slaves? There may be more people hiding in plain sight, he suggested to Laurel. We should amble on and poke our noses everywhere.
We should be looking for food. Boys are always hungry. So are dogs.
The next lot of buildings were storehouses. Laurel had paid very little attention to those since nothing lived in them. But when Perry walked up to the first open door he saw and made an examination, he was stunned at the amount of weaponry he found inside. Next to that storehouse was one for dry goods, mostly food. Next to that were other sorts of supplies. And when he added it all up, there were weapons, jarred and bagged and barreled and boxed foodstuffs, and other supplies enough for a small army. Hundreds of men and their support staff. More than was stored up on the hill back home, that was certain. No wonder he was eating so well. The only thing these men needed to keep supplying for their rations was fresh meat, and not all that much of that, just enough to make broths and gravies. Then there was the open space he had seen before where the men practiced, and were indeed practicing now, under the watchful eye of their captain, who spotted Perry and gestured to him to join him. Perry obliged, wondering what the captain wanted. Had the captain noticed he had been wandering about? Or had it been reported to him that the dog boy was putting his nose in places he hadn't ought to go? He swallowed a little as he approached the captain, doing his best to conceal his trepidation. But the reason the captain wanted to see him turned out to be innocent enough.
Dog boy, are you feeling well?
The captain asked.
After meeting the master yesterday, are you all right?
He seemed genuinely concerned, even a little paternal. Despite all of the horrible things that were going on here, Perry found himself liking the captain, who seemed to be a good man and certainly seemed to be concerned about a lowly dog boy. He looked at the captain from under his hair and finally nodded.
Dog boy,
he said, making sure he sounded a little subdued.
Would you like to take the dogs hunting tomorrow?
The captain asked.
Boar hunting?
Perry straightened a little and allowed a more cheerful expression to pass over his face.
Dog boy, he agreed. Hunt!
The captain sighed with relief.
Good. Hunting will be a lot easier with your pack than without it.
Perry got the feeling he was speaking more to himself than to Perry, since Perry couldn't be expected to understand too many words. Then he sniffed and took a good long look at Perry.
You were busy this morning?
Dog's clean, he said proudly. Dog boy clean.
The captain patted him on the head, not unlike a dog.
Good dog boy,
he replied, then proceeded to ignore him in favor of supervising the fighting practice. Perry stayed next to him for the next half a candle mark or so, watching the men train. It was a discouraging sight. They were very good as any guardsman Perry had ever seen, and if they were all that good, the king would need more than the usual company of bandit-chasing guards to face them. In fact, it would be army facing off against army in a siege situation, which was never ideal for the besiegers if the besieged had ample food and water available. He remained there long enough to get a good sense for the skill level of all the men currently practicing. Then Perry wandered away. The captain didn't stop him, which was at least a little encouraging, since that suggested the captain was comfortable with him going anywhere he chose. There was only one more set of buildings. One was the kitchen that Laurel had poked his nose into before. The cook, who turned out to be a very friendly man, was making a stew of beans and salt pork, and he stopped long enough to give them both some slices of hard sausage before they even got around to begging. The cook oversaw four more men. Three were normal enough, but one had similar head scars to Perry's helpers and seemed just as feeble-minded. There was definitely a pattern emerging here, but what did it mean? One of the remaining buildings was a hen house, built for 100 hens or more, it looked like, and populated with fewer than 20. They scratched among the litter of pine needles on the floor and clucked to themselves. Unlike the dogs, the hens didn't have a yard to go out into, but there were big, though barred windows, which brought in plenty of light and air. And there were shutters here on the inside that could be closed up to keep them safe and dark at night, or to keep weather out. These hens can't have been here when the army first arrived. They must have brought the birds with them or gotten them later. Did mercenaries carry hens with them? He didn't know. And the last building was something he'd been wondering about. One enormous, multi-holed latrine. One, from the looks of it, and the relative lack of smell, with either a cavernous cesspit beneath it, or actual tunnels to carry the sewage away somewhere else. This was actually the most impressive piece of work he'd seen here, especially if it did indeed have sewage drains. He resolved to come here from now on, even though it was a long walk from the kennel. Using a bucket in the kennel was not much to his liking. He made sure that his return trip to the kennel was just as aimless as the journey out. He and Laurel investigated the buildings they had already looked into, and they even spent some time talking to a couple of the horses. By the time he got back to the kennel, the dogs were all waking up from their naps, relieving themselves, and looking for something to do.
They're about to get into mischief, Laurel judged. They've been on good behavior until now because your arrival upset the regular order of things. But now they're used to you, and...
And I'm going to nip that in the bud, Perry said firmly. He stood in the doorway of the kennel and whistled shrilly. Every head came up, including the helpers. Ignoring the four humans, Perry summoned the dogs to him with a thought. When they were gathered around him, he made it clear to them that they were going to have a long run around the periphery of the courtyard, just like yesterday, but that this time they were to run full out, with Laurel in the lead, as if they were hunting. He caught their eagerness at this idea, and he got the sense that they had not had a full-out run since they had arrived here, and their old dog master. He couldn't make out what had happened to their dog master. It was as if he was gone, yet still present. And that made no sense whatsoever. He chose a dog at random and went down on his knees beside it. He looked deeply into its eyes and told it to think of the dog master that was there and not there. He got a confusing image, as if two memories were warring with each other. Instead of letting the confusion continue, he forced one that felt like the newer of the two, to come to the surface. It did so only briefly, but as it slipped away again, he sat back on his heels in a state of cold shock. It was one of his helpers. When Mags awoke, Roya and Dalin were gone, and the cave was very quiet. His sleep had not been very restful. He'd been unable to put Perry's precarious situation out of his head. He remained lying quietly for a while. He wanted to think, without anyone else's mind voice interrupting him, and this was about the best chance he'd had to do that. He lay flat on his back and locked his hands together on his chest, then let whatever was seething in the back of his mind come to the fore. Arvel isn't happy about his orders. That was the thought that swam up out of his subconscious first, and no wonder. They were all in this situation because Perry hadn't been happy with his orders and had disobeyed them. And if Perry had disobeyed, what was Arvel likely to do?
I don't think Arvel is the kind to directly disobey. But if I don't give him something productive to do, he's likely the kind to find some loophole or other to wiggle through and make his way out here.
And that would only make things worse. Arvel did just fine puttering around Withern, but out here in the woods, Mags was less than confident. All right, then. What productive thing could Mags give the old man that would keep him where he belonged, but give him a sense he was providing direct help? He didn't think too hard about it. He just lay there and waited for something else to swim to the surface. And what emerged was a fierce longing for something more in his hands than a simple belt knife. And while he was wishing, salt. And something better than the bare camping supplies he had. And a list of things he needed or merely wanted piled up in his head, and then he had his answer. This told him exactly what he could do to keep Arvel out of trouble. One companion, completely unburdened, could make it to Withern in a few candle marks. Two companions, loaded with packs, even if one was old, could make it back by morning tomorrow.
I heard that, Dalin said.
I like it. Roya can boost you just as easily as I can so you can reach Arvel with mind speech at the usual time. If I leave sometime before noon, I can be there before sunset. When I get there, I can tell Pelas what we're doing. He'll tell Arvel, and you can give me a list to give to them. Write out that list, and if you think of anything after I've left, you can add it when you contact him.
It would be better if you had adequate weapons, Roya agreed, butting in. There will probably be a need for them.
Thank you, O shining ray of sunshine, Mags retorted. He sat up and reached for his shirt. I'll make the list before I do anything else. Now he was grateful that he'd packed and repacked and re-repacked that damned caravan. He knew where everything was stored and could put his hand on what he wanted in the dark. And if for some reason Arvel couldn't manage to find a few things, well, Arvel's house was a sort of miniature guard supply depot. Chances were, Arvel had 20 of whatever he was going to ask for. He was just grateful he'd thought to include paper and a scribing stick when he was packing for this venture. He'd almost left them behind. If he hadn't had them,
you'd have used the inner bark of a birch tree, you goose, Roya reminded him, and soot. Concentrate on your list.
Roya had found him a mushroom the size of a bread loaf and had brought it to him impaled on one of the Dahili's horns. That made a more than adequate breakfast while he was making out the list. He included Perry's weapons on it. If there was any chance he could get them to his son, he wanted to try. When the list was done, he rolled it into a tight tube, tied it up, and tied the tube to Dalin's neck. Once the companion was certain it was secure, he was off like an arrow, vanishing into the forest before he could blink. Only then did Mags realize he'd been bent over so long writing his list in the tiniest possible characters that his back and shoulders were cramped and aching, and so were his hands.
Get a bath, Roya ordered, wrinkling his nose. You stink. And wash your clothing. It stinks too. If those mercenaries have noses, they'll find you by the stench alone. Follow me.
Roya led him away from the cave to a brook, went away and came back with a piece of soap root held delicately between his teeth. It looked as if he must have dug it out of the ground with his hooves, as Mags had seen goats do to get at a particularly favorite root. He spat the soap root out at Mags's feet and left again. That might have been to give Mags some privacy, but somehow Mags doubted it. One of the Daihili does turned up some time after he was clean and redressed in his wet clothing. It was warm enough today, he figured, it might as well dry on his body, and timidly offered to guide him to food. He assumed she meant strictly vegetarian fare, but food was food, and he accepted it gratefully. She paced her way delicately through the forest, pointing out mushrooms here, wild carrot there, herbs in the shadow of a bush whose buds could be eaten. This was good for him, slowly gathering foodstuffs, leaving as little sign of his depredations as possible, was occupying his mind, which badly needed occupation. He was stuck in one of those horrible situations where there was nothing he could possibly do that would make things any better, but not doing anything was going to drive him insane. Of course, Arvel was probably feeling that even more than he was. He'd managed to gather enough roots, greens, and mushrooms for 3 or 4 meals when Roya suddenly appeared out of nowhere, startling him and the doe he was with. She actually prunked straight up in the air before she recovered herself, and he was just glad his gleanings were tied up in a sack he'd made of a thin blanket, or he'd have been stuck with picking everything up again.
"We have an opportunity, but it is a short one," Roya said without preamble. "One of my stags has caught one of the men from the city out foraging alone and put him to sleep. You and I can pick his mind, leave him with some foraged food to make him think he simply lost track of time, and be gone without his master knowing anything about it. We may not get much, but it will be more than we had."
He looked at Mags and snorted.
"Much as it pains me, mount. If we go only as fast as your 2 feet, we shall take all afternoon."
Mags did his best to mount respectfully, and the Daihili shot off as fast as a companion could move in this forest, where the footing was so uncertain. It was the most uncomfortable ride he'd ever experienced. Actually, uncomfortable was an understatement. The Daihili had a very prominent spine, and Roya bounced with every step, leaping through the undergrowth like a deer or a rabbit. Mags did his best to cushion the effect by gripping with his legs and trying to move with Roya rather than counter to him. But there was only so much he could do, and he wished with all his heart for a saddle or at least some padding, and he blessed every god he'd ever heard of when the ride was less than a candle mark. He was off Roya's back before the Daihili even came to a full stop. The younger stag was standing over the prone body of a man dressed like the three in the inn, sleeping peacefully with a slight smile on his face. Wasting no time, Mags knelt in the bracken beside him, put one hand on his forehead to facilitate his gift, and let his mind sink into the mercenaries. "How did you come here?" That was the first thing he wanted to know, and not just because the answer would tell him if these people were native to the area or came from elsewhere, but because the images would very likely give him a good rough count of how many men there actually were, whether the mercenary himself knew or could count at all. The images came to him, dreamlike, and he was looking out of this young man's eyes. He and his company, it was a full mercenary company, had marched up from the south, carefully skirting the Valdemar border, because they had heard odd things about those heralds. They had a contract, negotiated by one of the many minor lords here in the halfway lands, between the really wild territory overseen by the mysterious Hawk Brothers and the border of Valdemar. Their new employer, Lord Fersen of Crag Keep, did not want his holdings swallowed up by Valdemar, and had bought their contract for the next 10 years. There was some talk of gem mines. He himself knew nothing of this. He only knew that finally there would be an end to all the marching, and probably to most of the fighting, and that they'd be in one place and could put down some roots. This man was very happy at that moment. He was very tired of fighting, of temporary camps, of tents in terrible weather. This new contract meant stability, real barracks, a chance to live like a normal human being. But they were doomed never to get there. He was too far back in the ranks to see what was happening, but the captain shouted, "Halt!" And halt they did. There was some talking. And then he was no longer in control of his own body, This was quite literal. He found himself marching again, tried to stop, and couldn't. He tried to shout with alarm, and couldn't. He couldn't even twitch a single finger. He panicked as he tried to struggle against this implacable, strange force that had made him a prisoner in his own body, but he got nowhere. He was completely under the control of someone else, and nothing he did could set him free. And from the stiffly marching men all around him, this power, whatever it was, had taken over all of them. Was it some hideous magic spell? Were they all under the control of an evil mage? Without really knowing how to fight this thing, he still tried to fight it, as he and all of his mates, the supply wagons, the dogs, the dog master, and all were marched down a side road, then deep into a forest. That was only the start of the nightmare. Although he could not control his body, he could feel everything. Feel when his legs started to burn from marching too long without a rest. Feel when his mouth grew parched and so dry his tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. Feel when his feet blistered, and then the blisters broke and bled. And still they marched. Past sunset and into the night, they did not stop. Not for a day and a night and a day again, although they were weeping and half mad with weariness and hunger. His head swam with delirium, and if he'd had control of his hand, he probably would have slashed his own throat to make it stop. Then, just as the sun began to set, a strange silvery city loomed up out of the forest. Mags noted there was no palisade around it at this point, there was just the forest. And then, with the trees pressed right up against it, the city. They marched into it, wound their way through twisting, confusing streets, then in through a gate in a huge fence at the heart of the city. All they could see at that point was one enormous building in the middle of a sea of waist-high grass, and then they were released, just as suddenly as they had been controlled. They all collapsed. He was sobbing with the pain of his feet and legs, and he wasn't the only one. Some of them were drinking from their water skins and weeping at the same time. Mags left that memory and asked the sleeping man another question. Who is the master? But the man didn't know. He heard a great deal about the master, and he knew that the master could peer into your head and see all your thoughts. He knew the master was the one who had controlled the entire company and brought them here, but he himself had never seen the master. That dubious honor was reserved for the captain and the few mercenaries that the master used as his personal guards. What does the master want? The poor fellow didn't know that either. But before Mags could ask another question, he got an answer to a question he had not asked. He was caught up in another memory, this time of the arrival of a caravan of wagons, all of them heavily laden with all manner of supplies. Mags understood from the memory that these wagons arrived regularly, with far more than was needed to take care of the needs of a single company of mercenaries. The master was stockpiling supplies, and the young man understood that the master paid for them in gold. The reason for this particular memory emerging soon became clear. After the supplies were all unloaded, the young man approached the wagon master and pleaded desperately to be allowed to come with them. He offered his entire life savings. The wagon master laughed at him and shoved him away.
Your master gave me 20 gold pieces for every trip, he scoffed. That's over and above the supplies, and you think I'm gonna risk that for the likes of you and a handful of siller?
The memory receded, shoved away, actually, by a desperate need to think of happier things. Things like, well, it wasn't so bad once they settled in. If you didn't somehow catch the master's eye or break the rules, life was good. Decent food, easy work, a real cot in a real building to sleep on. And once they'd been there a while, each man had managed to contrive a pine needle-stuffed mattress that wouldn't have been scorned in a real barracks. You just had to keep away from the master. Never break a rule. Never try to run. It wasn't all that different from some of the other places he'd served, or so he told himself. Of course, they weren't getting paid, but they weren't actually fighting either. Sometimes three or four men took a supply wagon somewhere and came back with it empty. And he had heard that more people, regular people, not fighters, were brought here from time to time. Certainly there were kids who ran errands that had turned up out of nowhere. He thought once or twice he'd heard a woman's voice coming from the captain's tent. But those were things it was just better not to think about. and so he buried them deep in his memory again and resolutely thought of nothing. Mags judged that was just about all he was going to get from the mercenary, which was far more than he had expected. He withdrew from the fellow's mind and slowly stood up.
"Are you finished?"
Roya asked. He nodded.
"I'll leave some of this stuff with him. We can leave, and the stag can wake him up as soon as we're all safely away,"
Mags said, checking his bag and bringing out a couple of handfuls of roots, several bunches of watercress, and some lumps of sticky pine gum, which had a lot of uses. He put that stuff down as if it had fallen out of the fellow's bag and started walking back the way they had come. Roya stepped in front of him.
"You'll take till sunset to get back on your own 2 feet," the Daihili said, amused. "I promise I will be slower this time."
Mags hesitated for just a moment, then gingerly mounted. He hoped he wasn't going to regret this. He was very, very glad that part of his gleanings included willow bark, because he really needed it. And he made a note not to ever, ever ride a Daihili again, unless it was an absolute emergency. And even then, it would have to be with something between him and that hard, sharp backbone. He comforted himself with the fact that Dalin would be back soon. By morning, in fact, so it should not become an issue.
I hope.
The willow bark helped. So did lying down. His injuries had settled to a mild ache when he sensed Dalin lurking in the back of his mind, waiting to be called. He decided to risk it. The bond between herald and companion was something that most mind speakers, no matter how powerful, had difficulty intruding on, or even sensing. "Arvel is collecting everything from your list," Dalin said, as soon as he opened himself to the companion. Mags could tell Dalin was tired but pleased with himself. "I sense you learned something without talking to Perry yet?"
"Quite a bit, actually."
He detailed everything he had gleaned from the young mercenary.
"I have a horrible feeling that this master is not going to be content to sit in his city with his own private army and abduct stray passers-by. I think he's going to use that army, sooner or later."
"That goes without saying," Dalin agreed. "The only question is what he intends to use it for, and who he intends to use it against."
"We are missing something here," Mags mused. "This all seems too obvious."
"That creature Perry saw was not exactly subtle," Dalin pointed out.
"But he wasn't stupid either. No, this isn't a straightforward territory grab. Look, he's already got a bigger city than he has the population for. He's not going to repopulate it with a couple of kidnapped women, and we're discussing someone who can control an entire mercenary company with his mind, making them march through their own exhaustion. I don't know what he's planning, but it's not just a simple attack."
He brooded over the problem for a moment.
"You know, he isn't actually using this city as a city. He's using it as a base camp. He doesn't intend to stay there."
Dalin considered that for a moment. "That seems a legitimate observation," the companion said finally. "So I suppose we need to figure out where he intends to go and what he intends to do."
"And I am out of ideas," Mags admitted.
"Is there anything more you thought of that you want?" Dalin asked instead.
"Aside from all the guard between here and Haven?"
"Not really." "You wouldn't really want all the guard between here and Haven," Dalin pointed out quickly. "This is someone who can control an entire mercenary company with his mind. As soon as they got within his range, they wouldn't be our guard anymore. They'd be his." And that was possibly the most unsettling thing he'd heard in a very long time. Perry got all the dogs settled for the night. They were much happier than they had been before his arrival. He could tell it by their relaxation and contentment. They really enjoyed being able to sleep together rather than confined in separate stalls in the kennel. They truly relished their fake hunt, following Laurel around the courtyard until they were completely exhausted. The men had enjoyed it too. As soon as they had realized what was happening, they began placing bets on the various dogs and cheering them on. But Perry had to wonder what the master had thought of that little exhibition. Had he even cared? Had he assumed that Perry was merely doing the proper job of the dog master? Did he even know what the proper job of a dog master was? There had been no sign from the big house that the master was watching. But who knew? 15. The dogs were mostly asleep when Perry finished his dinner,
They were so used to his presence now that the bony lumps nestled together by twos and threes in the soft dark of their stalls didn't even move as he passed them with his lantern. He hung the lantern on a hook just outside the kennel door and went out into the courtyard to see what the men did at that time of the evening. If they were anything like the guard, they'd be gathering in groups of friends, trading stories, telling jokes, taking care of little individual jobs like mending their clothing or equipment. The courtyard was silent. The only men moving were those who were heading for the barracks, presumably having been relieved by the night watch. There was none of the talking and signs of camaraderie he'd been expecting.
I guess these fellows aren't like the guard. Then again, the guard doesn't have a mind-speaking cannibal watching what they do.
He and Laurel didn't act as if they found anything amiss. They just ambled in the direction of one of the stable buildings that was showing a light, figuring that there would be someone awake in there. And that was indeed where he actually found some of the mercenaries, including the captain, gathered, in what would have been the feed and tack room if this had been in use as a stable. They had a single lantern in the middle of the room, as if it were serving as a campfire, and the men sitting on barrels and boxes around it were busying their hands with various tasks. But there was not much talking going on. Perry lingered at the door, just at the edge of the lamplight. Finally, one of the men happened to see him.
"Dog boy," he said, sounding surprised. "Can't sleep, lad?"
The rest of the men turned to look at him as he nodded. The man who had spotted him gestured to him to come join them. He and Laurel eased their way into the room. Laurel took up a spot on the floor and lay down while Perry used him as a backrest. No one else did much more than look at him. It was so quiet in here that his ears started to ring. They all sat in silence for a very long time, so long that he feared they weren't going to talk at all. Finally, one of them cleared his throat and broke the quiet.
"Dog boy,"
he said, his voice full of unease.
"Did the master give you food?"
"No eat,"
he said with alarm, half starting up.
"It's all right, dog boy," the man said hastily. "As long as you didn't eat anything, you're fine."
"No eat,"
he repeated, sitting back down again. He considered adding something, but decided he wanted to keep Dog Boy as simple as possible. But the men relaxed after that, and although they didn't speak very much, they did at least drop a word or two here and there. He learned that there was a regular supply caravan, one that brought twice as much in the way of supplies as they actually used. It had come in just before he arrived and was expected again in a fortnight. He learned that the captain paid the caravan master in gold that he got directly from the master himself. He learned that the mercenaries themselves were paid in gold too, but it was irregularly, and the intervals had increased with every moon they had spent here. They hadn't had a payday in 3 moons now, but instead of speaking this angrily, they spoke of it sadly in resignation.
Which made no sense. Why didn't they leave?
"Maybe they can't," Laurel suggested.
"Surely he can't control them all,"
he objected.
"What if he can?"
That question brought all of his thoughts to an abrupt halt.
What if that creature in the big house could control an entire company of men with his mind? That changed everything.
That meant there was no way they would dare bring the guard against him. He could take over the minds of an equal number of them and force them to turn against their own friends and fellows. That would be an unmitigated disaster. Worse than an unmitigated disaster, it would be catastrophic.
What if that was what the master wanted?
What if that was his big plan? To keep kidnapping people until Valdemar took notice of it and sent up the guard. The ones he didn't kill outright, he could capture, imprison, and, at his leisure, reduce their minds to nothing and make them his own. Then all he'd need to do would be to wait for more guard, and more guard, until he had an army.
"It could be done," Laurel admitted. "There were mind speakers in the ancient days who were that powerful. The stories of the Kairi say that they could also turn friends against each other, or break the mind so that you considered your old friends to be your foes."
He shuddered. This was horrible. He had to tell his father.
"I need to tell the Kairi, too. This creature doesn't seem to realize we are intelligent, but if he ever does, I am sure he will want us as his complete slaves, just as he enslaves humans."
Wait, if he could do that, why wouldn't he have done that to the mercenaries here?
Perry couldn't help but think that the only thing that was keeping the mercenaries here was fear that they'd simply be marched back to the compound. So maybe the master couldn't change anyone's mind in that way. Laurel, who had been as tense as Perry, relaxed a little.
You are right. But we know he can take over an entire company and force them to do his bidding, so he can still do terrible things to your guard.
How long before his father would speak to him? Surely it was much too early. Mags would have to be absolutely certain the master was asleep before he tried. And if Perry went back to the kennel to wait, all he would do would be pace the floor or toss and turn on his bed. So I might as well stay here. They passed around a thin, sour wine in a leather wine flask. The men all seemed to enjoy it, but when Perry tried it, he made an elaborate face and waved it away, and they laughed. That moment of humor seemed to make them relax a little, and either that, the wine, or both, loosened their tongues. And they talked, as men will, about women they had bedded, and epic drinking sessions, and embarrassing stories about one another. Truth to tell, aside from the kidnapping and captivity of innocent people, which most of these men didn't participate in, they seemed perfectly ordinary.
It is much easier to hate someone when you don't know them, Laurel pointed out. Nevertheless, what do you think the captain's reward was? I think it was one of those captive women, and I am sure he made use of her without a second thought. So they may seem ordinary, but they are by no means blameless, and it is a mistake to think of them as being anything like your guardsmen.
Laurel was right. He knew Laurel was right. These men were doing horrible things, and he had to keep that in mind, no matter how nice they were to him personally. But it was very hard when they seemed not much different than people he knew back home. He didn't learn much else from them this time. Some of them decided to play a dicing game, and others began whittling on carvings, mostly spoons. Finally, Perry yawned hugely and got up. Avoiding the dice players, he padded out the door and into the night. By the stars, he was pretty sure it still wasn't late enough for his father to contact him. It was extraordinary how slowly time passed when you didn't have something interesting to do. But after all, that was why Lord Jorthan and his father always said, the life of a spy is long spans of excruciating boredom punctuated by moments of sheer panic. He decided to test something. He and Laurel walked all the way to the entrance to the courtyard and the guards there. He looked at the gate, and then at one of them. The man shook his head, slowly and deliberately. All right, then. There would be no getting out that way unless the master allowed it. So now he knew. They turned and made their way back. The extraordinary thing was how quiet it was. No sounds of night birds, no sounds of insects, just the occasional clop of a hoof as a horse shifted its weight somewhere in its stall. The sounds of the guards at the gate pacing back and forth, and the occasional footfalls of someone on his way to or from the privy. On the way back to the kennel, he examined the big house. There were lights in a few of the windows, but most of them were dark, especially on the top floor. Was the master asleep yet? Then, just as he reached the kennel, he felt it. A strange chill. The oppressive sense of being watched and something he couldn't properly describe that made every hair on his body stand on end. It made him want to shrink down as small as he could and not breathe to avoid being seen. It only lasted for a second, as it swept over him as if he were inconsequential, but he knew what it must be. It had to be the master, making a survey of his domain. He held his breath, froze where he was, and concentrated on keeping his upper thoughts full of images of the dogs, but it didn't return. But he had broken out in a cold sweat, and he was still shaking when he got back to the kennel.
When we leave on the hunting trip tomorrow, I will memorize the way in and out, Laurel said unexpectedly, as they settled themselves for the night in Perry's bed.
You can do that?
Laurel coughed. All right, not memorize, exactly. I'm going to... scent market.
Perry thought about asking what that meant, then thought better of it since Laurel was obviously embarrassed by whatever it was. Though he had the shrewd notion it meant that Laurel was going to dribble a little urine along the way, and if he stayed in the middle of the pack, no one would notice. That wouldn't last past the next rain, but maybe they would be going out to hunt more frequently once they'd passed the initial test. Because this was a test, he was sure of it. And at that moment, He heard his father's mind voice in his head, whispering, as though he too was afraid to attract the attention of the master. Quickly, Perry told him what he had learned, and what he surmised.
"You were a step ahead of me,"
Mags replied, sounding chagrined.
"But that makes it all the more urgent to deal with him somehow, and it is imperative we get this information back to the king quickly. Is there anything more that you can tell me?"
"Only that I'm supposed to take the pack out to hunt tomorrow."
"That's probably a test, to see if you try to make a run for it, and to see if you can truly command the pack. Not necessarily in that order."
"That's what I figured. I'm going to be a good and obedient dog boy."
"If they start sending you out regularly, if Roya and I can figure out a way to hide you from the master, that might be the time to get you out of there."
But another idea had already occurred to him.
"But if they trust me and start letting me and some dogs go out on our own, that might be the way to get you in here."
"I'd rather get you out and deal with the master on ground of our choosing,"
Mags replied firmly, and Perry could see his point.
"Be very careful, Perry. You're doing an amazing job."
And then the contact, the presence in his head, was gone. Feeling lonelier than he ever had, he curled up with Laurel and resolutely closed his eyes. He needed to make the best impression he could on the morrow, because, given the capriciousness of the master, his life might depend on it. The captain opened the kennel door to find himself facing Perry with all the dogs behind him sitting quietly, all of them looking up at him expectantly.
"So, you remembered we were going to hunt today," the man said, looking pleased. "That's more than I... Let's go. We have a long walk ahead of us."
Perry knew very well what the captain was going to say. "That's more than I expected." But that was fine. In fact, it was more than fine. It meant he was giving a sufficiently convincing performance of someone who was addled. He whistled to the pack and led them out. The dogs had not been fed. He'd feed them double after the hunt. Feeding them before all that strenuous exercise would make them sick at least, and at the worst, it might even kill them. The designated hunters of the day went in front. It was pretty obvious from the fact that they were carrying boar spears they intended to go after wild pig. He could certainly see why they would want the mastiffs for that. He and Laurel walked in the middle of the pack. The hunters were not making any effort beyond a walk, and since he didn't know the way out, there was no point in getting ahead of them. This early in the morning, the streets were shrouded in shadow, and it was damp down here and chilly. The only scent his pitiful human nose could pick up was that of cold, damp stone from the slate roofs, but Laurel's more sensitive one wasn't picking up much more than that. The early sunlight was just gilding the peaks of those strange roofs. He tried to sense if there was any sort of animal life in or around the houses lining the streets. He got nothing but a few birds, and those were just passing over the city on their way to somewhere else. It was as if this unwelcoming place actually repelled animal life, too.
"That's probably because there is nothing to eat in those houses or their yards," Laurel pointed out. "Why should mice or rats live there if there is no food nearby? And there hasn't been any for a long, long time. Why should birds nest here if they have to fly much too far to bring food back to their young?"
It was truly a dead city then, and it gave Perry very uneasy feelings to be passing through it. He could tell that he wasn't alone in feeling that way. The hunters gave the empty houses uneasy glances when they thought no one was looking. He was very glad when they got to the gates and out of the city. They swiftly trotted through the field of stumps, and once they were at the edge of the forest, the hunters stopped, and one of them made his way through the milling dogs to Perry.
"Dog boy," he said, enunciating each word with great care. "We are hunting pig. Do you understand?"
He nodded, making his hair flop into his eyes.
"Hunt," he said. "Pig."
And he crouched down among the dogs and made meaningless whistles at them, as if he were communicating with them in some sort of language only they and he understood. They gathered around him in listening attitudes, although, of course, what they were listening to was all inside their heads. Obviously, communicating with them in a way only they understood was exactly what he was doing, except he was speaking directly into their minds, showing them the quarry he wanted them to track and what he wanted done with it when they found it. First, to find a herd of pigs, keeping them relatively close to the hunters while they ran the herd to exhaustion. Then, to pin them somewhere they couldn't escape from and give tongue when the pack had done its work. He stood up, made a sweeping gesture, and the dogs milled around for a bit, then moved off at a walk. The humans all followed, working deeper and deeper into the forest until suddenly, three of the dogs to the far right of the rest of the pack raised their heads and bellowed, then took off at a run, with the rest following. The humans all followed at a trot, but they were soon outdistanced. The hunters didn't look concerned, probably because they trusted his control of the dogs, and Perry wasn't at all worried. The dogs had their orders, and they'd obey. For now, it was mostly a matter of keeping track of where they were. The hunters moved off to his right, and Perry followed. They emerged on top of a hill overlooking a meadow with a single enormous tree spreading ancient branches above them. From there, it was much easier to track the pack as they belled in pursuit of their prey. Perry stood there with his eyes closed, staying in touch with Laurel and the former pack leader, cautioning them to slacken their pace when he could tell that the pigs were about to turn and stand at bay, and helping them keep the herd together. And he was tracking the pigs mentally, too, though it made him feel a little guilty, knowing he was basically herding them to their deaths. The dogs had managed to crowd two separate herds together, one of females and their piglets and half-grown weanlings, and one of sub-adult males. There were probably as many as 10 females and 5 males, and most of the females had litters. The cook was going to have his hands full preserving most of that meat, because even with a full company of men, they'd never eat it all before it went off. The pigs would probably be running at full speed, except that the piglets couldn't keep up. The young subadult boars were still more used to following the matriarch of the herd than running off on their own, and in this stressful situation, they had defaulted to their piglet behavior. This was why Perry had to keep the dogs at a mere trot. That was the fastest pace the piglets could manage, running at what was for them full speed. He kept his mind with the dogs as much as possible, but he couldn't help feeling sorry for the pigs. The only thing that kept him from abandoning this hunt altogether was that he could see signs already in this part of the forest that the pig population was much too high. They were destroying the undergrowth with their rooting and digging. He saw places where the meadow below them was dug up and ruined, and they had probably dug so many wallows near ponds and brooks that they were well on the way to ruining the water with muddying it. It was clear that there weren't enough predators in this part of the Pelagiers, and these pigs were very close to causing harm that would take years, if not decades, to repair. Wolves were the usual predators for wild pigs, and he hadn't heard any wolves since arriving here. Probably the mercenaries had trapped any wolves or run them off, and this was the result. A population of wild pigs that was now out of control. He kept reminding himself while directing the dogs that this was something that had to be done.
If these men weren't here, I'd bring in Kairi to hunt them until the wolves came back,
Laurel observed, and licked his chops at the thought of a suckling pig. Finally, even the adult pigs were exhausted. Laurel had already located the perfect ambush point, a little cul-de-sac among some rocks. Now he took over the front of the pack as Perry ordered them to spread out to keep any of the pigs from escaping. About a candle mark later, the pigs were all milling frantically in the trap, and Laurel bellowed the at-bay bark, followed by the rest of the pack. Perry didn't need to tell the hunters. They could recognize the change in the dogs barking for themselves. With a shout, they headed down the hill in the direction of the noise. By now, of course, everything in this part of the forest that wasn't in hiding had fled to quieter realms, and there was very little chance of being attacked, even by a bear, so the hunters were putting their best pace on without worrying about what might be in the way. Ordinarily, this sort of reckless behavior on their part would be suicide, but not today. They came out of the forest again to find themselves facing a field of enormous boulders, the smallest being at least twice the height of a man, the largest 2 stories tall. These boulders formed a sort of crescent shape, and the pigs were now trapped in the bottom of the crescent. With the dogs keeping the pigs pinned, the hunters strung their bows in a leisurely fashion and began picking off the piglets one by one. The air filled with the metallic scent of blood. The sows squealed as their piglets began to fall, 5 and 6 at a time. Perry closed his mind to the fear of the poor animals. This was a more efficient way to hunt, certainly, but it was terribly cruel. At least these men were good at what they did. They never had to use a second arrow, and the piglets died instantly. But the smell of the blood drove the entire herd of swine frantic with terror. All that skill with the bow doesn't bode well for the guard if it comes to fighting them.
Dog boy!
the leader of the hunters shouted over the din of the dogs when the last of the piglets lay unmoving on the ground. Perry trotted over to him. Once again, the man spoke slowly, with careful, small words.
Can you get the dogs to let one pig at a time through to us?
Perry stuck his finger in his mouth, gnawed on it, and pretended to think with a furrowed brow. The man was surprisingly patient. He didn't shout at Perry or repeat himself. He just waited until Perry allowed his face to brighten.
One pig,
he said, nodding and turning toward the pack. Again he made meaningless whistles as he told the pack to look up at him, and then he gave them their instructions, showing them what he wanted them to do. When he was sure they had it all firmly in their heads, he shouted,
Go!
Four of the dogs dashed in and startled a young boar at the far left edge of the herd. Seeing four dogs charging down on him, he squealed and ran instead of charging. The dogs opened up a corridor for him, and seeing a path to escape, he burst into a gallop, right onto the spears of two of the hunters. As soon as he was dead, the dogs repeated the performance. Two of the eight hunters left when there were only about three sows left, including the matriarch. At this point, Perry thought for a moment that they might let the remaining pigs go. After all, they had more than enough meat, and the cook and his helpers would probably be working day and night to get it all smoked for preservation. But no. When the last pig was dead, the hunters started butchering, gutting the piglets first. The leader called Perry over to him again.
Dogs hungry?
He asked, gesturing at the growing piles of offal, which were perfectly good as dog food.
Yes,
he said, simply, and lined the dogs up in a row, giving each of them a careful portion of the bounty. Now it was all over, and at least he wasn't being bombarded by the terror of the pigs, just the hunger of the dogs who had been working long past their breakfast time, and were ravenous. By the time they'd finished eating, the hunters that had left returned. They had brought all the horses to pack the meat out with. The hunters were positively gleeful. Perry was feeling a little sick. It had, after all, been a slaughter, and an unfair one. Since the dogs were still eyeing the meat, and he caught visions of stealing out of them, he rounded them all up and headed back toward the city, leaving the hunters still packing up the bounty. Laurel led the way. He had to marvel how sure the Kairi was of exactly where he was and where they needed to go. But he realized, as he got away from the scene of the hunt, that he had learned a lot about these mercenaries by watching them. He knew now they had some expert marksmen. He knew they favored solid tactics and a well-thought-out approach to dealing with an enemy. He knew that they did not flinch, not even when a boar was charging straight for them. That was more information his father should have. And meanwhile, now Laurel knew the way into and out of the compound. That was a definite plus.
And the guards might not let me out, but I bet they'd let him go. He could make his way to the palisade and see if there is another way in or out.
Things might not be as dire as he had thought, at least not for the three of them. And at least not for right now. Pelis had not done more than nap before leaving just after noon. Mags thanked him profusely for his help and begged him to stay until he was rested, but the companion was clearly uneasy about being so far from his chosen and wanted to go back immediately. Mags felt one hell of a lot better with real weapons at hand. Not that they would do much good against someone who could control an entire army of mercenaries with his mind, but there were a lot of perfectly ordinary men in that place, and perfectly ordinary weapons worked against them just fine. Even though at the beginning of this trek he had thought he was going into wilderness territory, he'd still packed up his roof-walking kit and all the things he used for climbing walls into the caravan with the rest of his gear. Now he was glad he had. It had occurred to him that if he knew the routes and timing of the patrols inside, he could get up and over the palisade and into the city itself without being caught. And he could get out the same way. If he could get Perry out of that inner court, he could get Perry out too. The only question would be how to extract Laurel. Dallin had eaten and immediately dozed off as soon as he was back, and Mags didn't blame him one bit. He must have put on every bit of speed he was capable of to get to Arvel's house as fast as he had. He had put a good face on it, but it had been pretty clear he was exhausted and needed a good, long rest to recover. Now he had finished unpacking everything the two companions had brought and organized it, and he was left with too much time on his hands before he could safely contact his son. So he sat down on his bed and began methodically and minutely examining all of his equipment and weapons. He tested the strength of every thumb length of his climbing rope and the strength of his grappling hook. He made sure the braided wire of his coiled garrot was free of kinks. He made sure the all-black skin-tight outfit he wore for night prowling was still free of holes that might allow a bit of bare skin to betray him. Was the wooden cone he used to listen through doors and walls still in the kit? His lockpicks? His wafer-thin latch-lifting knife? And when he was certain that everything he could want or need was here and in good order, at least it was time to cook some supper. After supper, he decided to take a walk until it was too dark to see. He set off alone, but it wasn't long before he was joined by Roya.
"Is this another form of pacing?"
the Daihili asked casually.
"I suppose it is," he replied aloud. "I want Perry out of there, but I need him in there. It feels as if I'm using him."
"Well, you are. And being what you are, you have to. You heralds all know the time can always come for sacrifice and self-sacrifice."
"That's just it. He's a child, and he's not a herald. Not yet, anyway."
"Perhaps when you are both done with this place, not ever. Would that be a bad thing?"
"I try not to think about it," he confessed, as the Daihili paced gracefully at his side. "I've been trying very hard not to put my expectations on my children."
The king stag snorted.
"That's not possible, and you know it. The best you can manage is to keep them from thinking you have any expectations for them."
Mags coughed.
"I'd ask how you know that, but I already know the answer. How many times have you been a father?"
"I lost count at 200.
Mags thought about that.
"At least they feed themselves."
"A good point."
They walked side by side through a forest that was slowly changing its face from day to night. It didn't become something entirely different, but it certainly was not the same creature it was by day. He put one hand on Roya's back, and they stopped at a little bluff that overlooked one of the many small watercourses that threaded their way through the forest.
Moonlight streamed down through the break in the trees, and the silence was shattered by the scream of a rabbit.
Mag shivered.
"I think we should turn back now,"
Roya observed dispassionately. It was a distinct relief when Roya finally said,
"The master sleeps."
Mags practically turned himself inside out to get to his son's mind, to discover that his son had been waiting just as impatiently for him. In fact, the instant Perry sensed Mags's touch on his mind, he began streaming thoughts almost too fast for Mags to pick up on them.
"And Laurel knows how to get out of the city to the wall now,"
was the last of them, and then there was nothing more distinct than the sort of circling repetition born of anxiety.
"You've done well,"
he said, trying to project that he considered Perry to have done at least as well as a fully grown adult so far.
"And you're right. The king has to know about all of this immediately. You are absolutely correct that sending companies of the guard against this master would be insane."
As he spoke to Perry, he was getting a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach, a feeling born of having known King Cedric so closely, and his father, King Kirill, before him.
"I think the king is going to order us to find a solution that won't involve the guard,"
he continued, being as honest as he could with the boy.
"And we must have a solution for him. We can't simply allow an enemy like this to lurk on our border and wait for him to make the first move. That's suicidal."
"Is there some sort of gift that could shut him off?"
Perry asked.
"I've heard that in the past. People have had their gifts burned out, but I'm not sure how,"
he replied after a long moment of thought.
"I'll send that suggestion along, but Perry, it's possible, more than possible, that he's too strong to do that to."
"Maybe you should ask Roya. He's awfully strong. He can control his whole herd."
Mags wasn't sure about that. What Roya did was not so much control as direct. At least it seemed that way to him. But it was worth asking. The problem was, Roya didn't have the same urgency about getting rid of the master that he and the king did. Roya and his herd could just leave, but Valdemar couldn't exactly pick up its border and migrate away from this danger.
"I sent Laurel to make a run around the inside of the palisade around the city,"
Perry thought, evidently deciding his father had been silent for too long.
"He's going to see if there are any other ways in or out of the city, or out of the courtyard. The guards didn't let me leave tonight, but They didn't have any trouble letting Laurel go for a run.
Mags felt a surge of intense relief.
I have my climbing kit. I can go over the palisade and come to you if you need me, once he finds a spot that's either unguarded or is only lightly patrolled.